It's 7:30 in the morning on a Monday. The four-year-olds at Rogers Lane Head Start in Wyoming are drawing lines with a ruler and cutting out strips of paper. Jazz Webb is here helping her daughter, Michaela.
Come on, let's cut another line.
Webb wears sweatpants and a black jacket. She's groggy, she works two jobs, and she never gets enough sleep. It seems like this moment couldn't possibly be significant. Just a four-year-old, a sleepy parent, and some construction paper. And yet, there's a surprising amount of evidence that moments like this matter a lot. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. For the next hour, we are going to talk about why moments like this matter for children and for the future of our state. And that story will take us into the world of preschool, its history in our country, whether it works, why it works, and whether it ultimately deserves your taxpayer dollars. But we are going to start this hour by talking about the brain. And, you know, you hear people say all the time that babies and toddlers have brains like sponges. But the truth is that scientists are really just beginning to understand how a young brain develops. And one of the things they've learned just in the last few years is that poverty can actually have a biological effect on the growing brain. So that's where we're going to start the hour, with the story of a brain growing up in poverty, told to us by some of the scientists on the leading edge of new research.
The message is pretty clear now from the science.
There are real structural differences in the brain as a function of family SES, family socioeconomic status.
Our circuits are constantly being altered by our experience.
There's no question about it.
My name's Lise Elliott. I'm Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School of Rosalind Franklin University.
The brain first forms about 4 weeks after conception.
There's a pretty steady formation of new neurons, which are the real information carriers. I calculated in my book, I think it's about 250,000 neurons a minute. 250,000 new neurons per minute between 4 weeks and 7 months prenatal. But they're not really connected to each other. Wiring up the neural circuits to do anything from seeing to talking to walking to doing calculus requires obviously experience.
Literally, our environment shapes the architecture of our brain in the first year of life. My name is Jack Shonkoff. I am the director of the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. What babies do right from the beginning, they look at you, they make sounds, they cry, and then they get a little bit older, they smile and coo and gurgle. And what shapes that brain circuitry is the response of adults around the child, what we call the serve-and-return interaction. The baby does something, the adult responds back. The adult does something, the baby responds. And it's the back and forth, the responsiveness, that shapes the brain circuits.
Yes. We actually have these microscopic changes in the way two neurons talk to each other that is capable of storing information. That is really where we get to the physical basis of learning.
So children who grow up in homes which tend to be more skewed toward more highly educated parents talk to their kids more, use more varied vocabulary, compared to children who, on average, in homes where parents have had limited education, tend to speak to their children less, use smaller vocabulary.
Whatever they're exposed to, those are the connections that will be preserved.
So by 18 to 24 months, you already see differences in the number of words a child can produce.
You know, sometimes people think, oh, if the brain is involved, if it's biological, that must mean it's genetic. And that in turn must mean, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And of course, that statement is wrong on many levels. But it's particularly wrong because we know that the brain is plastic. It is shaped by its environment. And particularly early on, it really needs the right environmental conditions to develop well. My name is Martha Farah. My title is Professor of Natural Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. And for the last few years, I've been studying the effects of childhood poverty on brain development. So we started by scanning some poor children from Philadelphia who have been followed since birth by my collaborator, Hallam Hurt. She's a neonatologist, so she got them when they came out. And when they were teenagers, we got structural brain images of them. We got MRIs of their brains. We found that kids who at age 4 were rated as having very supportive caretakers, typically mothers, but not always, their hippocampuses were different at age 15, 16 from those of kids who had less attentive, less warm parenting. Their hippocampuses...
The hippocampus. Back to the hippocampus.
...were different. So, it turns out that the hippocampus is involved in two, on the surface, very different things. One thing it's involved with is stress and stress regulation. Another important function of the hippocampus is memory. And you might say, you know, what the heck is the hippocampus doing these two totally unrelated things for? But it turns out they're not totally unrelated. Because in evolutionary time, you know, you could imagine, you know, when you see, you know, your next door caveman eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, you want to remember, ooh, saber-toothed tigers are really dangerous. I'm going to really stamp that memory in strongly.
Stress is kind of a double-edged sword. A little bit of stress is a good thing. It motivates us. You know, a child would never learn how to walk if they didn't take the risk of trying to stand independently. But then too much stress can be toxic to the brain.
When it's, you know, stress day in, day out, the system wasn't designed to handle that. Chronic exposure to stress hormones is actually neurotoxic. It kills brain cells.
What's happening is you become stressed out, you become increasingly stressed by experience, and sort of short-circuiting activity there, sort of like flooding out an internal combustion engine. My name is Clancy Blair. I'm a professor in the Department of Applied Psychology at New York University, and I study self-regulation in children, which is a variety of things, including the regulation of emotion, the regulation of stress physiology, and regulation through cognitive skills referred to as executive functions.
Executive function.
Executive function skills, the ability to focus attention.
Focusing attention.
The ability to control your impulses.
And that is just critical for everything. You can't focus on cognitive learning if you're upset.
If you haven't had a chance to learn to regulate at a very basic physiological level and to regulate attention and emotion, you're going to get in trouble in situations in which you need to do that. And I'm very interested in the effects of experience on the development of prefrontal cortex.
Prefrontal cortex, the very front of the brain.
Which is the area of the brain that's associated with the executive function.
It turns out that the other place in the human brain that has lots of receptors for stress hormones, other than the hippocampus, is prefrontal cortex.
The idea is if children are under stress and experiencing a lot of stress in the home or in school, there's a neurobiology behind that that's related to why kids are having problems with attention, why kids are having problems with memory.
For young children, the challenge of poverty and the stresses of poverty is not a function of the family's income. It's a function of how well the parents, the caregivers, are able to kind of modify and adjust and moderate their behavior to create a safe and enriching environment for the child. So there are lots of parents living in poverty who do a magnificent job providing a good environment for early healthy development. But parents whose stress is related to poverty make it really difficult for them to be available emotionally and engaged, and who are preoccupied with just kind of keeping a roof over their head. That stress can interfere with their responsiveness to a young child, and that's when a child feels the stresses of poverty. The message is pretty clear now from the science.
There are real structural differences in the brain as a function of family SES, family socioeconomic status.
Whatever they're exposed to, those are the connections that will be preserved.
The effects of poverty on children's development are pervasive, and they last throughout early childhood and into young adulthood. There's no question about it.
It's beyond frustrating to think about just kind of looking at these children and saying, well, you know, we'll, if you have trouble later, we'll deal with it. You know, if you don't finish school and you're less of a productive citizen, or in the worst case scenario, you end up in jail, you know, we'll have to deal with that. To think that so much of that is preventable is unconscionable from a moral point of view. And from an investment point of view, it makes no sense whatsoever. So frustrating is an understatement.
Those were the voices of Lise Elliott, Jack Shonkoff, Martha Farah, and Clancy Blair. Philip Glass was on piano, playing the role of the brain. So, this brain science we just heard about is pretty new, but the idea of having programs to help young children in poverty is not new. And coming up, we're going to unearth some old audio from one of the biggest moments in early childhood education in our nation's history.
I believe that this is one of the most constructive and one of the most sensible and also one of the most exciting programs that this nation has ever undertaken.
47 years after the launch of Head Start. Has it worked? The answer, coming up in about 10 minutes on our State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio.